cannot be naive and not see the volume of problems we have here, not see that we are severely constrained by financial resources. And so, you know, if I'm honest looking forward, I'm not pessimistic, not optimistic, I'm realistic and worried whether we can really live up to the huge expectations. You know, that what keeps me awake at night is making sure we have the resources to do the little that we can as well as we can.
A dose of realism there from Matthias Schmaler, who's got one of the toughest and most challenging jobs anywhere in the UN. He's the Gaza director of the agency that helps support Palestine refugees across the Middle East, UNRWA. I'm Matt Wells, and for this edition of our Lid Is On podcast, we'll go inside Gaza to hear firsthand how what used to be a hard but bearable existence, thanks to a basic UN safety net, has now become a struggle for survival. Siam Al-Khalout is a Palestinian mother of seven whose family is sliding into sickness and despair. Her words are voiced for this podcast by an interpreter.
Even for the unemployed, there are cuts. All of this will affect our nation, and the nation will be pushed over the edge. Gaza, the afflicted Gaza, every 3 or 4 years it gets hit. So where will all the people here seek refuge? We need UNRWA. That's where people will look for help. It's the foundation of life here.
This is the main distribution center in Shati refugee camp, or beach camp, one of eight throughout the narrow and crowded strip on the Mediterranean coast in the Gaza City area. It's home to about 84,000 registered refugees out of around 1.3 million, many of whom have been stuck here for decades across Gaza. Nearly 2 million people in total are crammed into the strip, blockaded by Israel since the Hamas militant group took control of Gaza in 2007 and forced out their secular rivals in the Fatah Party, which runs the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. There's been a partial thaw between them, but as Nikolai Mladenov, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East, told the Security Council a few weeks ago, key obstacles remain that have left much of Gaza's creaking public sector in disarray.
Mr. President, despite these setbacks, I'm encouraged that the Gaza crossings continue to be controlled by the legitimate Palestinian authorities after their handover on November 1st. I also welcome the decision on the 3rd of January by the Palestinian president to resume payments for the full amount of electricity, or 120 megawatts, purchased from Israel for Gaza, allowing for an increase in supply to 6 to 8 hours of electricity per day. The humanitarian situation, however, remains dire. With the current funding available, the United Nations will not be able to provide fuel to hospitals and critical infrastructure in Gaza beyond the end of February. I also take note of Israel's decision to approve some 85 private sector projects through the Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism since the start of this year. Yet these positive developments are not an alternative to the lifting of the closures on Gaza and to the returning of the Strip to the full control of the legitimate Palestinian Authority. The combustible cocktail of humanitarian, political and security challenges must be addressed urgently and effectively.
Caught between intra-Palestinian politics and the economic stranglehold of the blockade, the UN's been warning for months that Gaza's near total collapse, with medical supplies dwindling, power cuts threatening hospitals, undrinkable water, raw sewage on the beaches and polluted fishing grounds. On top of this, a decision in January by the US to withhold more than half its annual funding commitment for UNRWA, a vital lifeline for refugees in Gaza, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria and the West Bank, has endangered its work across the Middle East. A major fundraising effort's now well underway to make up the multi-million dollar shortfall. Here's Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking at the beginning of February.
The United Nations country team in Palestine has predicted that Gaza will become unlivable by 2020 unless concrete action is taken to improve basic services and infrastructure. Yet Gaza remains squeezed by crippling closures and a state of constant humanitarian emergency. 2 million Palestinians are struggling every day with crumbling infrastructure, an electricity crisis, a lack of basic services, chronic unemployment, and a paralyzed economy. All of this is taking place amid an unfolding environmental disaster. I'm extremely concerned that the latest shortfall in UNRWA's funding will gravely impair the agency's ability to deliver on its mandate and preserve critical services, such as education and health for Palestine refugees. At stake is the human security, rights and dignity of the 5 million Palestine refugees across the Middle East. But also at stake is the stability of the entire region, which may be affected if UNRWA is unable to continue to provide vital services to the Palestine refugee population, both across the occupied Palestinian territory and in Jordan, Syria and Lebanon.
So what does all this mean for the people of Gaza, who are just trying to live and raise their families in what many see as the world's largest open prison? We asked Gaza-based journalist Hazem Baloucha, who files regularly for our UN News Arabic service, to give us a sense of how daily life's changed as pressures build both inside and outside, with no end to the crises in sight. His interview with Siam Al-Khalout was conducted entirely in Arabic, so we voiced it into English, courtesy of our Arabic colleagues.
My name is Siham Al-Khalout. I have 7 sons living with me and their father. Of the 7, 4 are sick, including their father. I'm sick myself. I have a heart condition. We are suffering in this life now. All of us are refugees. We are suffering. As you can see, the house is so small and the conditions are really bad. Some of my sons used to go to the university, but they are staying home now. I have no money for them to go after the agency cut our benefits. We used to have full food rations as well as other benefits, but now we are taking only the yellow coupons. They tell me that this is because my son is employed by the agency, UNRWA. I tell them he's married and not staying at my house, and the cuts deprive the sick here at home of many things. Rations and benefits were stopped in the same year, and this has led to the bad conditions we face at home right now. With respect to medicines and education, when I feel sick and tired and need medications, I can't find them. When we go to UNRWA, we are told we must stick only to the yellow coupons.
Next, she's asked how the level of support has changed for the family from UNRWA.
We used to have a full benefits coupon. They would even come to our house and fix things. Although we have the right to fully rebuild our house, 3 or 4 floors, as matches the number of people living here, they say they can only fix things, not rebuild. 10 years ago, they said they would rebuild the house, but nothing happened. Nobody's talking about it now. This has to do with UNRWA cuts and the amount of money available. As for my sons, they have no opportunity to work. One of my sons is a graduate from the Institute of Community Services, and he was top of his class. He works as a volunteer. No institution or organization is able to meet our needs. The country is dead. UNRWA is the only effective agency in the Gaza Strip to help the refugees from all the suffering we face. And there is another problem. When I go to get my medications are not available in the hospital. I find only baby aspirin and a pill I put under my tongue. But the important medicines I really need, I can't find. I've been living without real medicine for the last 3 months. I have sick family members here and just the yellow coupons. As the saying goes, they do not offer special privileges. For instance, employing the unemployed, like my graduate son, I want him to live a normal life. And I can't ask them to offer my son a job because we are on the yellow coupon system. And we don't have privileges anymore. And UNRWA was the only means of support.
Hazem asks Ms. Al-Khalout what income the family has beyond UNRWA.
One of my sons gives me money, and from this we can buy food. And he brings me some medications because he's afraid something bad might happen to me. But I don't take the money for my medication. I would rather feed my children. I can't get my medicine and leave them hungry. I wouldn't be a proper mother otherwise. The house is humble and simple, but it's giving us shelter. And we pray to Allah that things will change for the better. Look at the poor refugees. There are a lot of them out there. I can tell you my story, and I'm sick. Others may not be sick, but they are hungry and can't find food and can't find anything. They can't afford to live. UNRWA was very effective. It organizes training courses, it employs people, it takes care of the people, and it goes to people's home and does the repair, even if they don't have coupons. I have had major problems with my bathroom since the 2014 conflict, and still nothing has happened. It's been 4 years, and they have not come to repair it. My problem is not about buildings. It's just that I cannot really survive. How can I move forward? And what about my sons, the youth? Where is their future? It's already destroyed. Please, UNRWA, you are the only support we have. You're the only support for all the poor people and all the refugees. This younger generation, they want to be well-educated. They don't want to have bad health, weak bodies and brains. So overall, UNRWA has been our main supporter.
So what does she think is the solution to the terrible predicament facing her and the many other Palestine refugees in Gaza? Is it all in the hands of UNRWA from her point of view?
UNRWA needs to be as merciful as possible, considering all the poor people around, and show more empathy. UNRWA has been around for generations of my ancestors. It's a huge agency, and it needs to be sympathetic to the youth, poor families, and mainly the sick. I'm suffering. I just went to run a small errand, and I'm gasping for breath now.
But UNRWA is facing huge cuts to its funding and appealing for more countries to donate. With desperation rising in her voice, Hazem asks her if she understands the very difficult position the agency's in at the start of 2018.
They have to try harder. UNRWA is not incapable of fighting them. Who is responsible for the cuts? Surely they can rise above this trivial problem. We are praying to Allah as refugees. Who will support us? Only UNRWA is supporting us. We've been relying on it for generations. Today, I'm in debt. If I don't give the lender their money back, they will not lend me again. UNRWA used to pay my debt. It used to pay for everything, educate my sons, feed them, and put clothes on their backs. I have 2 graduates. One is just sitting in the house. So you see, even for the unemployed, there are cuts. All of this will affect our nation, and the nation will be pushed over the edge. Gaza, the afflicted Gaza, every 3 or 4 years it gets hit. So where will all the people here seek refuge? We need UNRWA. That's where people will look for help. It's the foundation of life here, the most important thing in Gaza. Don't tell me this political faction or that. UNRWA is the sole supporter for refugees in the Gaza Strip, regardless of other countries. May Allah help Gaza and its people.
The stoical and resolute Siham Al-Khalout. Let's hear now from Matthias Schmaler, director of UNRWA in Gaza. He's been with the agency for around 3 years, having worked first leading the operation in Lebanon, then on to Syria, before heading to the New York office. He's been in charge in Gaza since last October. Hazem Baloucha asked him how the first few months had gone.
Gaza, despite its many challenges, is an absolutely fascinating experience and a daily roller coaster of emotions. What I mean by that is, on the one hand, I am really very positively surprised by the number of people who are well educated, very motivated, and despite all the challenges they've experienced in their life, 3 wars, more than 10 years of blockade, are trying the best with a very positive mindset to make the best out of their lives and their challenging circumstances. So for me, I didn't expect that to the scale I'm seeing it. Just the sheer number of people motivated and educated. And so there's huge potential. That's one aspect. On the other hand, I'm not naive in terms of the misery that exists. I think it is a collective shame for the international community that in a place like Gaza, we have to feed 1 million people every quarter. That should not have to happen. The only reason, or the main reason for having to do so, is the blockade. With all the potential I've mentioned, it would be so easy. And one of the solutions for the way forward is lift the blockade and give people opportunities to find work, to move, to better their lives. But for the moment, this is one of the very miserable aspects. Our social services colleagues tell me that the poverty among refugees, the 1.3 million refugees that we serve here, has risen over the last 2 years by 15% to 77%. So 77% of the refugees we are responsible for live below the official poverty line. That speaks for itself. 64% unemployment among young people in Gaza, including the refugees. So when I talk positively about the opportunities, the potential, the good work, I should not be naive and also acknowledge it happens in an environment that is incredibly difficult and complicated, and I think in particular characterized by the blockade.
As you heard from previous directors or from other colleagues, you know, how would you describe the life in Gaza? There is a report issued by the UN saying 2020 Gaza wouldn't be livable. What do you think about that?
I think that was a very real report when it was issued, I think about 2 years ago. I cannot back this up with any scientific data. My feeling is that 2020 is too long as a time horizon for this becoming completely unlivable. I think we're much closer to that. If something dramatic doesn't happen soon, Gaza will become totally unlivable soon. And, you know, again, I've mentioned some of the indicators: rising poverty levels, rising unemployment levels. Our health colleagues speak of an epidemic of psychosocial problems, you know, indicators of people attempting and succeeding with suicide. So there are a couple of worrying indicators that suggest we are very close to this place becoming unlivable. If you then add to that the electricity crisis that started on a serious scale last year, and you know, I don't need to tell you, with 3-4 hours a day maximum of electricity supply. So I think wherever you look and you start thinking about economics indicators, social indicators, etc., the health service, you know, many hospitals, I think the service delivery in hospitals breaking down, it is a very, very worrying picture. And I think 2020, saying by 2020 Gaza will be unlivable if nothing happens, is too optimistic, unfortunately.
You mentioned the blockade. Do you think the blockade is the only solution for Gaza?
I think it's a major part of it. I really think lifting the blockade has to be an important step. Of course, it doesn't stop there. There are two other considerations that are important. And the first one is the blockade is a form of the occupation. I know the Israelis are not inside Gaza, they're blockading it. Putting this in different terms, a just solution has to be found for Palestine refugees and for the state of Palestine. I really think so. Lifting the blockade alone is not enough. It will make life easier, it will improve opportunities for the economy and so on, but a lasting solution depends on an overall just solution. I also think, and that's why there has been so much attention correctly on the so-called reconciliation process, I do think that the Palestinian leadership needs to do more to truly represent the aspirations of its people and to govern with more unity and effectiveness. Again, that in itself is not enough, but I think it would be wrong not to talk about the future and mention the need for greater and more effective Palestinian leadership.
I met some refugees, and refugees are not fully satisfied with the UNRWA services. I mean, they always need more, always asking for more help. I mean, UNRWA recently is reducing some of the services, so that would affect their life standard. What do you say to them?
I think it is correct to say that the needs, and let's talk specifically here in Gaza, are so overwhelming. We talked about the poverty levels and the high unemployment. You know, we provide 13,000 permanent jobs. There are 13,000 UNRWA positions. That's only a fraction of what's needed to give people employment. So UNRWA is not in a position, is what I'm trying to say, of meeting all the needs. There's always a possibility to do more. And in those terms, we are really just basically constrained by the resources given to us. And so wherever we've had to reduce what we do, it's linked to financial resources. That's one aspect.
What I also hear as questions is the quality of UNRWA's work, you know. And I think there we can and should improve. So as an example, people do complain that in our schools not enough is done to make them violence-free and safe and healthy and fun places for children to learn. So what I'm trying to say is it's not just a question of the quantity of what we do, and there are limits there because of finances. We are also a big organization which has existed for a long time, and you know, sometimes things become a bit bureaucratic, a bit a traditional way of doing it. And so I think when people question what UNRWA does, they are right in challenging us to do the best we can to always keep improving.
I can say that you are optimistic.
If UNRWA senior staff start being pessimistic, you know, with all the misery we've talked about around, it would give the wrong signal. So yes, I remain optimistic given the potential I see here. I wouldn't say it's a question of optimism versus pessimism, but realism. I cannot be naive and not see the volume of problems we have here, not see that we are severely constrained by financial resources. And so, you know, if I'm honest looking forward, I'm not pessimistic, not optimistic, I'm realistic and worried whether we can really live up to the huge expectations. You know, that what keeps me awake at night is making sure we have the resources to do the little that we can as well as we can.
شكرا جزيلا.
شكرا.
Matthias Schmaler there, talking to our UN News contributor in Gaza, Hazem Belusha, and trying to be as realistic as possible about the often overwhelming need that faces both the UN team there and, more importantly, the Palestine refugees who are living in desperate conditions throughout Gaza through no fault or choice of their own. You've been listening to our Lid Is On podcast from UN headquarters in New York. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening.